Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome to the podcast. I hope you're well. Thank you so much to everyone who responded to last week's pod. Wasn't it great? Kyle Gray, what an absolute star. Just really, I just love the way he's so down to earth and yet just so uplifting. It really does make a difference when you focus on the angels taking care of you, right? And focus on the good stuff, you know, and just very grateful for that reminder that we have to keep our vibes high. I just think it's so important. I don't think it's ever felt more important than needing to just kind of keep yourself uplifted. And God knows we have to do it, don't we, with everything that's going on. Particularly when it comes to booze. I could not believe the conversations that have been, you know, in the media this week around alcohol with all the, you know, Partygate shenanigans and stuff. It's just so interesting. You hear it with completely different ears when you are no longer drinking. You really do, because you see alcohol for what it is. Let's not sugarcoat it. It's a drug. You know, it's the most harmful drug if you take into account absolutely everything, harm to the economy and the health service and God knows what. You know, as, you know, in the words of the great Jason Vale, alcohol is the only drug you have to justify not taking. And that was completely borne out, wasn't it, in the week with, when was it? Was it, I don't know, Tuesday or Wednesday when there was all that furore about Sue Gray's report. And then the 1922 committee, it was Harriet Baldwin, wasn't it, who suggested that alcohol should be banned in Downing Street and in government departments. I mean, perfectly reasonable suggestion. I'd have said, you know, number one, on account of it's a drug. Number two, on account of that's meant to be a workplace. Number three, on account of look at where, it, you know, the mess it's got them into, literally. And Boris Johnson's response, you know, oh, ha ha. We may not have won the Second World War if alcohol hadn't been available in Downing Street or something like that. I mean, just not funny. Actually, not funny. It's just, oh, I mean, the Emperor's not wearing any clothes, right? At some point, we're going to find this. But alcohol in the workplace, it's bonkers. It's absolutely ridiculous. I was really blessed this week to be able to do a little presentation for a company where the woman who runs it is a leader, a proper leader, who actually wanted to reach out to some of her staff members and offer them the opportunity to find out more about potentially ditching the booze and focusing on that in a completely positive way. That's well-being in the workplace, being able to, you know, share that inspiration and inspire people that there's another way. And I really think if more leaders and bosses were like that, you know, the workforce would be completely different, wouldn't it? Everything would change. Anyways, there's my rant for this week. I really hope you're all good, and it's starting to feel like summer, which is always helpful. I was really lucky to be able to go to Claire Pooley's book launch for her second novel. Obviously, anyone who's not aware, Claire is the author of The Sober Diaries. It was the book that changed my life, really, kick-started everything for me, completely changed my life, and because of that, I got the energy and the mojo and the support, really, to stop drinking. And then since then, Claire has become a mega successful novelist. It's so brilliant. I'm so happy for her. The Authenticity Project was just the most wonderful book. And now this new one, The People on Platform 5. So I was lucky enough to go to the launch at Daunt Books. And it was just so lovely to see Claire. So if you like your novels, make sure you get yourself a copy of that. Just a reminder that we have a couple of events. We have Sober by the Sea on June the 11th. There might be a space left. That's in Southend. It's a very tiny event. We focus on what it is you want for your life. You create a vision board. It's very relaxed. It's totally non-judgmental. Doesn't matter what stage you're at. You'd be very welcome if you're interested. And then on July the 17th, we've finally booked the Family Constellations Day. So that's going to be in Kings Langley in Hertfordshire. Family Constellations, too big for me to describe in a sentence, but have a look at some of the posts I've written about it. So if you go to thesoberclub.com and just click on events, you'll find it there. Anyways, this week's guest, oh my goodness, this is a big topic. You know that over the years I've touched on different aspects of nutrition and diet, in inverted commas. And of course, you know, we cannot deny the fact that when people stop drinking, often, not always, but often, there's a little voice in their head saying, oh, I might lose weight. Or, you know, there's that kind of thread that runs through it. And, you know, we're a diet obsessed culture. There's no doubt about that either. And I, as I say in this interview, have really struggled with this one. Yes, I have done loads of diets in the past. Now, I don't think diets work, but I also don't, I don't feel I've ever really found the absolute definitive answer until possibly now. this is a real, you know, this is one of those interviews that's going to turn everything you thought you knew on its head. So I found Saskia Carr through her amazing work that she does on Instagram. She has a huge following. She's just absolutely brilliant at what she does. She's also going to do an exclusive session for us in the Sober Club. So very much looking forward to that. Enjoy this interview and do let me know what you think. I'm so pleased to be able to discuss the topic of intuitive eating, and really pleased that my guest is Saskia Carr, an intuitive eating mindfulness and body image coach. There's so much we can talk about. Welcome, Saskia. I'm so pleased you could join us.
Thank you so much, Janie. Excited to chat with you.
Yeah, and especially as we've actually made it happen, you're in Sydney and I'm here. I mean, that's just amazing. The wonders of technology, right?
The wonders. And we're all used to Zoom now, at least.
Yeah, exactly. Just about. Yeah, just about. This is such a big topic. So I don't know how much we'll get to cover. But the reason this came about is because, you know, on my podcast, I've covered obviously lots about nutrition and recovery, lots about the sugar monster that, you know, so many people who've ditched the booze find that this kind of sugar monster moves in with them and tells them they need ice cream at 2 a.m. you know, or whatever. So we've spoken a lot about that. And then a few weeks ago I interviewed someone who had written a book that was all about self-love, but this particular book was angled towards losing weight, if you need to lose weight. And that my whole focus around this interview was to really look into this piece of how important it is to basically start to take care of yourself, and, you know, to want to be in the best health you can be. That's always been my raison d'être. But I was kind of made aware that it might not have been taken that way. And one thing I absolutely want to make 100% clear is that I am not an advocate of weight loss. You know, what the hell, any more than I would say, it's crazy. It has to be about loving yourself ultimately, doesn't it? And it has to be about, as you call it, intuitive eating, and just getting to know your own body. So I really wanted to speak to somebody who, you know, this is their sort of passion. So let's start with that, because you're 2 years sober, right?
I am. Yeah. Yes.
So, yes. So you're the perfect person to kind of unpack all of this with, hopefully. So let's just start with that then. What is intuitive eating? What does it mean?
Yeah. So intuitive eating is a self-care eating framework, and it has 10 principles. And essentially, we're all born intuitive eaters. We're all born knowing how to eat. We all born knowing to eat when we're hungry and stop when we're full. But over our lives, we pick up all these different external rules and basically forget how to trust our bodies. And we become alienated from our natural relationship to food and get sometimes overwhelmed by all these confusing and often contradictory rules. So for me, intuitive eating taught me how to trust my body's sensations again, and it felt like a homecoming. You know, it's all about learning how to trust and listen to our bodies to tell us when, what, and how much to eat. So instead of saying, you know, should I have this, or is this healthy, or do I deserve this, you get to ask yourself questions like, do I want this food right now? Or do I like how it tastes? Or am I going to enjoy it? Or how does it make me feel?
Mm,
Yeah, I love that. And I mean, I think that, that you know, if we look back, you know, depending on your age, your mum, your grandma, it wasn't always the same, was it? Because we didn't have such an industry around food years ago. You know, it was much more a case of people ate what was grown locally, you know, what was available, you know, regular meals. There wasn't the diet culture that there is now, certainly not to such a, to set the same extent. And there wasn't the kind of, you know, fake food, for want of a better word, you know, ultra high processed foods that are just super bad for you and actually designed to make you want to eat even more, you know, and not to mention the sugar. There wasn't the same amount of sugar and crap around, I don't suppose. So I think something changed over the years. And then, of course, we also became obsessed at some point with looking a certain way, with having to come up with a certain image. I mean, what's your view on how things have changed in, I don't know, 50, 70 years?
Well, look, it's interesting. So when we talk about diet culture, I really like the description from an author called Christy Harrison, and she describes diet culture as, you know, putting thinness on a pedestal and equating health with moral virtue, promoting weight loss as a means of attaining higher status, and demonizing certain ways of eating whilst elevating others.
Yeah.
And what she talks about is that diet, or the word diet, isn't very kind of sexy anymore. It's quite 90s. So what we have now is more this wellness diet, or this kind of modern incarnation of diet culture, which still has a lot of fear around food.
Mm.
And that might be fear around sugar or fear around processed food. But still, it is a way which creates a relationship with food where we're not 100% peaceful with it, because whilst there may have been changes in the industry, when we take a food and we kind of feel fear around that food, or we elevate certain types of food and demonize others, it kind of gives food a moral value. Yeah. And what we're trying to do with intuitive eating is see all foods as morally equal. So we understand that broccoli and chocolate don't have the same nutritional makeup, but we don't see that we are bad people or that one food is good or bad. So processed food with intuitive eating does fit, like all foods fit. And what we find is that when we give ourselves unconditional permission to eat all types of food, our relationship with those foods changes. So sugar is a perfect example. So when I was dieting myself, I was absolutely convinced that I was addicted to sugar. It had a feeling of addiction to me. I would remember a feeling of like an ice cream calling me from the freezer and like this real needing to eat it. But what I found was, over time, when I gave myself unconditional permission and access to eat sugar whenever I wanted it, my relationship to it completely changed. And even the research around sugar, what we see with that is the research is about rats. And when the rats have that out of control reaction to sugar, it is when they've been fasted or given intermittent access to sugar. So I know it can feel like addiction, but the whole concept of food addiction is, you know, the research is quite questionable. And what we see from people is that when we're given access to food, and when we stop having rules around it or what we can and can't have, we really change in the way we relate to it.
I mean, I know there are going to be people listening who think, well, I can't quite get my head around that, for the reason that, you know, I can understand that from the place of, if you are very comfortable in your own skin, if you do feel balanced, if you do love yourself, you know, if you've got a few of those pieces in place, from that place, I can understand it. But if you're someone who is feeling really quite chaotic, maybe you've only just stopped drinking, and you feel out of control, that's just the way it feels, and then you give yourself permission to have as much sugar as you want, you're going to end up feeling utterly miserable, aren't you?
Well, look, it's one of the biggest fears people have with intuitive eating. So people say to me, if I gave myself unconditional permission to eat sugar, I would just
be sitting around.
It wouldn't end well. I'd be sitting eating, you know, ice cream all the time, and I'd never be able to stop. But it's not actually backed up by the research. So there is a whole body of research around habituation, and it's that idea of, you know, the leftover effect. If you had pizza on Friday night and then ate it again on Saturday night or Sunday night, well, first of all, it probably wouldn't taste very good by that stage, but you just kind of, the excitement's taken away from it, and also the scarcity mentality. So if you are eating sugar, but what is going on in the back of your mind is like, this is naughty, I'm bad, I'm doing something wrong, I'm going to have to get myself together tomorrow, the diet starts tomorrow. You've got this scarcity mentality, so you want to get it in all while you can. If you know that you can eat it tomorrow, the next day, forever, for the rest of your life, it is very different. And coming back to your question about the feeling out of control, there is an early stage in intuitive eating where you will be eating a lot of previously off-limit foods, and that is definitely a phase. But you move through that phase and you reach a new phase. And my clients will say to me on a call, I cannot tell you, I've got chocolate in the cupboard and I forgot it was there. Mm. I didn't even know it was there. I mean, my husband would hide chocolate in the shed because he wanted it in the house. And I would say, I can't have that in the house. I simply can't have it, or I'll eat it all. And now I can have chocolate all the time in the house and have it when I want it, but I don't have that relationship to it. So it's only really by doing it and going through the process where you think, this is amazing. And the point is not that you stop eating that food. It's not that you burn out on sugar and never want to have it again. It's that you can have it when you want it. And there might be sweet food that you find that when you actually give yourself permission to eat it, you don't even like it as much as you thought you did.
Yeah. I mean, everything you're saying really underlines this truth that food is so linked to emotions, or at least that's how we make it, don't we? We have all these associations, you know, that, as you say, you know, I'm bad if I have that, or, oh, if I'm feeling miserable, sugar will be a comfort, which of course starts in childhood, doesn't it? You know, you fall over and you're given a biscuit or a sweet, you know, to dry your tears. I mean, that has to change, surely, that association with food as comfort. What's your view on that?
I think food is a beautiful way to comfort yourself. I think that if food is your only coping mechanism and you don't have anything else in your toolbox, that might start feeling not very good for you. But I think we've really demonized emotional eating, and I think food is a beautiful tool to comfort yourself, and it's a beautiful way to celebrate and connect with people. And I think in our culture we have this thing like, you should never eat for emotional reasons. Well, it is a beautiful way to do that if it's used in the right, you know, I don't want to say the right way, but in a way that feels good to you. And also, we know that people with a dieting history are more likely to use food as a way to cope with their emotions because they have a setup of that scarcity of it. But I would say it is one of the tools that you can put in your toolbox. There's something about food which is grounding and can kind of help bring you back to the present moment. I had an experience the other day where I was feeling really angry and frustrated, and I went down to the kitchen and I was like, I want something crunchy. And so I got out some chips and I had this kind of crunch.
You took it out on the chips.
And it was like this really satisfying feeling. And I can now kind of have chips in a way that I eat how much I want and I stop when I'm done, and they fit. But I think it's okay to use food in an emotional way, particularly, you know, when you're not when you're not restricting food or controlling your food, you have a very different relationship to it.
Mm. Yeah. So do you not believe, do you believe then, do you think that certain foods, obviously I would say things like, you know, highly processed foods, are, in inverted commas, addictive in the same way that, you know, alcohol is addictive. I'm sure we can agree on that, right?
I definitely can agree that alcohol is addictive.
So on that sort of thought process, alcohol is addictive. And for someone like me, I don't have an off switch. So when I was drinking, you know, the alcohol was addictive. I did not have an off switch. And so I couldn't stop at one. And you know, it was a terrible combination. My husband, on the other hand, absolutely had an off switch. Was not a problem for him to have one drink and not drink again for 3 weeks because it wouldn't cross his mind, because it wasn't a thing for him, right? But it was absolutely a thing for me. So in this, in a similar way, do you think that some foods are addictive, and that therefore, if they are, and then there's someone who doesn't have an off switch to that food or that kind of food, they're gonna end up with an imbalance there?
No, I don't think food is addictive. I definitely think
well, even like ultra processed foods and really, wow.
No. So, and look, there's a lot of research to back that up, and I can share some of that with you, you know, for your listeners to read. But I would absolutely agree that alcohol is addictive. We can agree on that.
Good.
There's a few things to point out. First of all, we don't need alcohol to survive.
Absolutely. Whereas we do
and
need food.
We need food to survive. Yeah. Abstinence is possible with alcohol, and it is not possible with food. What we know with alcohol is that, you know, having freedom around it doesn't work for the vast majority of us in this space. However, what I would argue is that the more you restrict your food and the more you control it, and the more rules you have around food, and the more you categorize it into good and bad categories, or processed or not processed, or whole foods or not whole foods, the more likely you are to feel out of control around that food.
Right.
And so it would be the opposite, I would say. I would say you need to allow yourself full freedom with food, in a way to not feel like that around it. I could be around processed food, not processed food. It doesn't change my relationship with it now that I have got rid of all those rules.
Right.
So I would say that there are foods that are going to be tasty and more palatable, but you don't find that sort of addictive behavior anymore in people who are intuitive eaters.
Wow.
And have given up those rules.
Okay. That's really interesting. So, I mean, how long does this process take then with the way you teach intuitive eating? How long would that process take before you know, as you say, you might go through a phase where you kind of, you know, it probably does seem like a relatively tricky balance that's going on. But how long does it take before you feel that that things are balanced? Because I suppose balance is where you end up, right? So that it feels balanced or not, or does it not? I mean,
well, yeah, look, it's a great question. It's a bit like, it's
how
a bit
long's
like
a piece of string.
Or how long does it take to stop drinking?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. True.
So for some people, it's a great comparison with drinking. You know, some people might have to try and give up drinking 50 times, 100 times before it's successful for them. The same with this. I found for me, when I gave up drinking, that I was in this new state of having my eyes opened to so many things. I was in this raw state, and I looked around and thought, what else in my life is like that?
Yeah.
You know, you've got rid of this alcohol. And then I was like, wow, my relationship with food, this is so disordered. You know, I spend all my time thinking about food, worrying about food, feeling bad about what I've eaten, feeling guilty. And so for me, I threw myself into it very quickly. But for other people, it might be just starting to read a bit and then getting, you know, getting the kind of research there and following people on Instagram. So it's very different for each person. It's going to depend on what sort of space they're in, how long they've been restricting their food for or dieting, and how quickly they can allow themselves to move into this process, because it's radical. It is so out there to say to somebody, I'm telling you, you can eat whatever food you like, in whatever quantities you like, whenever you like, and your body is going to tell you how to do that. Mm. But people have, we're so out of tune with
that. Yeah, we are. We are totally out of tune. I absolutely agree.
And
I
so for me, you know, alcohol really takes us away from our intuition.
Yeah.
And I think that diet culture does as well. So what I find really sad is that people can leave alcohol behind, this thing that kept them trapped and that numbed them and that kept them disconnected from their intuition, and then leave that behind and start going into all these, you know, this obsession with food and what they should be eating and what they shouldn't be eating. And it's still not listening to their bodies. It's still external things telling you what you should be doing and what you shouldn't be doing. So in answer to your question, it can take some people 6 months. It can take other people 3 months. It can take people a year, 2 years, more. It's really dependent on the individual and their situation. And also it is dependent on whether or not that person is going to recover in a smaller body or if they're going to recover in a larger body, because for those recovering in larger bodies, they're doing the internal work and working on their own personal body image, but then they have to go into society where weight stigma treats them in a really horrendous way, and where they experience weight stigma at the doctors and where they don't have the same access to public spaces and all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, it is dependent on the individual.
Mm. But just talking about that for a moment, you know, you as you say that, you know, that's a great phrase, you know, those recovering and a larger body, you know, that's exactly what it is. But what about people who, you know, who, for whom it's hard to even phrase this question, because I don't know how to say it in a way that doesn't seem, I mean, I'll just say it because that's what people are going to want me to do, right?
Okay. Yes.
if you feel that you are carrying extra weight that's not serving your health, you know, forget about what society says, forget about looks and trying to look a certain way. If, I mean, I'm sure we could agree that there can be a correlation between health and weight, right? Could we agree on that?
We could agree that there is a correlation.
Yeah,
yes.
That's not all I'm saying. I'm absolutely not saying that thin is good. 100% not. But if you are carrying weight to the extent that you feel unhealthy in your own, you know, in your own body, so it's not about how you look necessarily, but you feel there are health issues. In that instance, would this approach work in terms of, you know, helping you to if weight needs to be reduced so that you feel more healthy, will that happen naturally because you're being kinder to yourself?
No, not necessarily. So with intuitive eating,
maybe you can think of a better question, because you probably know the one I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, no, I can answer it. So let me answer your question first about intuitive eating. Intuitive eating is a weight neutral approach. Yeah. So there is nothing to do, and I want to be really clear, intuitive eating is not about losing weight. Intuitive eating is about improving your relationship with food and improving your relationship with your body.
Yeah.
And that may result in your body staying the same. It may result in weight gain and it may result in weight loss, depending on how closely you were to your natural body's set point weight range. So that's first of all what I wanted to say. The second thing is that I really want to acknowledge that body diversity is real.
Yeah,
you know, we could absolutely all eat and exercise exactly the same and have totally different bodies. We've been sold this myth that we're fully in control of the size and shape of our bodies.
Yeah.
And it's just not correct. There are over 100 different factors which impact our weight. And so much of it is about genetics. And we simply don't have a safe, effective, or permanent way to lose weight. So that's the first thing to say.
Yeah. I mean, just on that for a moment, just to chip in there, I think, you know, you've explained that really, really well, because it's always frustrated the hell out of me that you constantly read articles saying that if your waist is bigger than whatever the hell it is, some like doll measurement, literally one of my daughter's dolls measurement, you know, like call the cavalry, you know, you're obese. And even with babies, you know, this ridiculous fixation on weighing babies and measuring babies. And if they're not exactly a certain weight within a few weeks, I mean, what the hell is that even about? It's bonkers. And the whole BMI thing, I mean, what is this? That kind of stuff really frustrates the hell out of me, because it's not one size fits all. It can't possibly be.
No. And the BMI is really not a good barometer of health. So absolutely. So we have body diversity and it is real, even though society would like us all to fit into, you know, the same mold. That's not going to happen. But also, weight and health aren't the same thing. I really want to be clear that weight and health aren't the same thing, and weight isn't a behavior. So we can engage in a lot of amazing health-promoting behaviors. We can move our bodies. We can increase our fruit and vegetable intake. We can improve our stress. We can work on our sleep and still not lose any weight.
Yeah.
So if we're actually focusing on well-being, let's step away from weight entirely. And what we know, as we said, is that there is a correlation between higher body weight and certain health issues, but we don't know why. So what we do know is that there's a possibility that the reason that these health issues exist is because of weight stigma and weight cycling, so yo-yo dieting, healthcare avoidance, and also discriminatory healthcare, which worsen both physical and mental health. And these could all be responsible, partially or entirely, for the poor physical health outcomes associated with being in a larger body. So, you know, studies show that weight stigma actually increases the risk of high blood pressure and diabetes and high cholesterol and eating disorders. So, you know, it's not risk-free weight loss. You know, there's dieting is, and when I say dieting, I'm not just referring to fad diets, I'm referring to lifestyle changes as well. They're one of the biggest predictors of eating disorders.
Right.
And eating disorders have doubled since the early 2000s.
Yeah.
So, you know, here we are telling people to focus on weight loss, and yet there is a lot of harm associated with that. So I would say, if you want to focus on your health and that's important to you, focus on health promoting behaviors, because that's actually something you can do. And as I said before, weight isn't a behavior.
Yeah, that's very powerful. That's really true. I also think, you know, what you said about, I forget exactly how you phrased it, but it just reminded me of, you know, the importance of when people first stop drinking. So many people decide they want to stop drinking. And one of their main reasons is because they decide they want to lose weight. So then they do that absolute devastating nightmare thing of putting themselves on some kind of hideous diet or fasting and also trying to ditch the booze. And it's just chaos. And actually the reverse is true. When you stop drinking, you absolutely need those good nutrients in your body. You need food. You absolutely need food, because of the brain chemistry piece is completely shot. So I can see how, you know, starting to focus on this approach, on intuitive eating, could really support that recovery process.
Absolutely. And we do know that people who've had, you know, issues with alcohol or a complicated relationship with alcohol also have a complicated relationship with food. Mm. We see it a lot.
Yeah.
And what I find, it's changing, I've noticed a bit, but I find that because a lot of sober spaces do focus on weight loss or do hold weight loss up as a perceived benefit, this means that those spaces become really unsafe for people who are in larger bodies or those who have a history of eating disorders or disordered eating. Mm. So if you go to a website that is, I'm thinking of an Australian one at the moment, and they are talking about one of the benefits of giving up alcohol is that you'll lose weight. What does that say to people in larger bodies? That it's a benefit to not look like me? So it's increasing weight stigma, and it just makes these spaces really unsafe. And I know a lot of people who just feel pushed out of sober spaces because of that. I am noticing a shift now. But, yeah, I think it's really important to separate those things to be more inclusive in these spaces.
Yeah, yeah. So for anyone listening who's, you know, really interested in this, where would we start? Can you give us just a couple of tips that we could start to think about if this is an approach we want to take?
Yeah, so intuitive eating, there is a book which is by Evelyn Triboli and Elise Resch.
It's right, maybe you can send me the link to that.
I'll pop it on the notes.
Yeah,
that's that it was written over 25 years ago, and it's a brilliant place to start.
What's that called?
It's called Intuitive Eating.
Okay, cool.
So that's where this whole thing came from.
Yeah,
and there are 10 principles of intuitive eating. So that would be a great place to start. I would also suggest reading the book Anti-Diet by Christy Harrison, who mentioned earlier. That is a brilliant book. And there are a lot of people on Instagram in the anti-diet space. There are more anti-diet and sober people slowly popping up.
Oh, good. Because I'm guessing that's an important kind of area for you, is that, you know, this connection with where this fits into the sober space, you know, this whole, well, just everything to do with, you know, the diet culture, the wellness thing, as we've already alluded to, it can slip into that sober space and actually stop people from going ahead and ditching the booze.
Yeah. And look, there are so many similarities too. I was thinking about this last night, and you know, when you stop drinking and then suddenly you're just there, you and your emotions.
Yes, absolutely. You have to feel all the feels.
Feeling all the feelings. It's the same with giving up food restriction, because food restriction, body dissatisfaction, and controlling our food is another way to cope. And it is another way to numb.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when you're sitting there feeling anxiety in your stomach, and then the next thing you think is, oh, I can't have a drink. I don't drink anymore. What will I do? Let's make a plan for my food for the week. How will I be good? You know, this sense of setting yourself boundaries and controlling yourself and making sure you're okay. Mm. There's a lot of similarities. So once again, diet culture, or moving away from diet culture, is just peeling back more layers and just finding more about you and being even more raw. So it is another layer to peel back. And I feel that once you've seen what you see with alcohol, you begin to look, as I said, at other areas of your life and notice what's happening there as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And where can we find more about your work then? How do you work with people?
The best way to find me is on Instagram. So I am at intuitively.eaton, and I do one-on-one coaching with primarily women, but all folks. And we do that via Zoom. So I work with people all over the world. And I think we mentioned this before, but I'm also a mindfulness meditation teacher. So I use mindfulness.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, cool.
So I use mindfulness in my work around
I mean, I'm guessing that's, yeah, I'm guessing that's very much part of it. That's very connected, because that's exactly it, isn't it? We have to learn to become mindful. So we can start to be comfortable in our own skin.
Yeah, and so we can reconnect with the sensations in our body as well. You know, when we're doing intuitive eating, we're asking our bodies to tell us when to eat, what to eat, how much to eat. So we're becoming more in touch with our hunger and satiety cues, our satisfaction cues. And of course, with mindfulness, we're becoming more aware of the sensations of our body and what that might be telling us in regards to how we're feeling or what emotions are happening for us. So there's definitely a lot of coming home to the body and trusting the intelligence of our body and the wisdom of our body, rather than looking out to some external person, some external book or program to tell us what to do.
Yeah, so important. And, you know, something I've touched on before is that, you know, you're so right. It's all about what's going on with, you know, how we feel about ourselves. It can't possibly be about the weight. And I've shared a story before about someone I know who used to work in that space of working with people who were slimming, you know, some kind of slimming, whatever it is, organization, you know, one of those things. And she had a situation where a woman had lost a massive amount of weight. And so they kind of gave her some accolade of, you know, slimmer of the month, or, you know, one of those awful things, and invited her to go and have a complete makeover and choose clothes and hairstyle and all of this stuff. And this colleague of mine, it completely turned her around. It changed her thinking 360, because she saw this woman who had been so desperate to lose weight to, you know, then become happy and, you know, everything to be good. And actually, when she took her out to kind of choose clothes, she really couldn't bear to look at anything. She didn't want to look in the mirror. It had changed nothing about how she was.
Yeah.
It was just, she was going to pick a different size off the shelf. That's it.
Yeah. You become more socially acceptable, but does it actually change anything internally? Yeah. I think that can be a really devastating thing for people to realize, that they thought, if I just got to this weight, I remember thinking to myself, I know that I'll be happy when I get to that weight. I know that I'll be happy. And I did get to that weight. And then I was absolutely paranoid about maintaining it. Yeah. And it was such an anxious place to be. And it wasn't where my body naturally wanted to be. I was in a weight suppressed state. And we are taught by diet culture that our bodies are the way to get us happiness, success, respect, love, and it's an illusion. Yeah. Our bodies can't get us those things.
Yeah.
They absolutely can make us more socially acceptable. They can make us closer to the, you know, the ideal cultural body of the time, but they can't get us those emotional needs met.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. It's fascinating to talk to you. It really is. Great stuff. I love it. I'll definitely have a look at the books that you mentioned. I'd love to dig a bit deeper into this. And where's your book? Have you not written a book yet?
I haven't written a book yet.
Oh, no. Come on.
I haven't written a book yet.
Okay, that'll have to be next.
Yeah, that'll be next. I've actually got two more books I just wanted to share that are sitting here. This book's brilliant. It's called The Body Is Not an Apology.
Great title.
Power of Radical Self-Love, and that's by Sonia Renee Taylor.
Great.
And then there is another brilliant book called What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Fat by Aubrey Gordon. And Aubrey Gordon also has a brilliant and hilarious podcast called Maintenance Phase. And they really do, she co-hosts that with someone called Michael Hobbs, and they do a brilliant investigation of the connection between weight and health. So fantastic. I would suggest listening to that. They spend, don't quote me on this, but something like 90 to 100 hours preparing for these episodes, and there is so much scientific stuff in there that will just potentially blow your mind. So
great. Amazing. Wow, definitely food for thought, literally.
Definitely.
Thank you so much, Saskia. I really appreciate it. You know, amazing work that you're doing. Thank you for giving us a different spin on it. You know, I mean, I thought I'd kind of been around the houses with all of this, but you know, here I am. I'm still saying stuff that actually, when I think about it, it isn't quite right. So, you know, it's really good to be challenged on all of this, and I love the idea that, you know, it's all food's food, right? And let's not demonize any of it, and let's not demonize ourselves either. Absolutely, yeah, love it.
Exactly. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for getting up early, and you're up early and I'm up late.
That's right. Yes, we've made it work though.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I'll put those links, if you can pop me the info for those books, and I'll put all that in the show notes, and obviously mention your where to find you as well. Thanks a lot, Saskia. Appreciate it.
Wonderful. Thank you.
So check out Saskia's work and the book that she mentioned. I've been really enjoying that. Make sure you, let me know what you think. I'd really, really love to know your views and what's worked for you with all of this. If you know, body image and weight and so is something that's been on your radar, then I'd love to know. I'd love to know your view. Just a caveat to everything. I won't ever stray from my opinion that if you're in the early weeks, in the first few weeks of not drinking, it is really important to get the protein in with every meal. You know, eat intuitively if that's what you're going to do, but really encourage your intuition to remind you that you need protein with every meal in those early weeks, because it's all about the brain chemistry, which needs to kind of recalibrate. So I'm really hot on that when I work with clients one-to-one, or even the stuff we do in the Sober Club. Just make sure you get that good nutrition in the early weeks. So thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I'm just going to do a little plug for I signed up to one of those little buy me a coffee things last week. They're just those little things where you can make a donation. And the only reason I did this is because I realised that, you know, of course, if you're a member of the Sober Club, you are supporting my work. And I'm so grateful to Sober Club members. It's such a wonderful community. But I know that not everybody wants to do that. And lots of people who listen to this podcast, for whatever reason, you know, it's not relevant for them, or maybe you don't like online groups, whatever. But maybe you still might want to donate a little bit of cash to the podcast to keep everything going. It's a bit of a labour of love. And the reason that I did this is because I was listening to a podcast that I absolutely love. And the guy on there was saying, you know, it's not free to do this. And if you'd like to contribute, you know, please do. And so he gave his little Patreon thing. So I thought I'd just set up that little buy me a coffee thing. So I think you literally go to buymeacoffee.com/JanieLeeGrace. I think it's that simple. Anyway, I don't know. I'll put the link in the show notes. And if you want to buy me a coffee, mine's a flat white. Okay. That's if we get to meet in person, which would be even better. I just thought I'd throw that in. And thank you again for listening to this regularly. And for those of you who let me know how much you're enjoying it, really, really makes a difference. So thank you. And I've got some very exciting guests coming up in the next few weeks. I can't reveal all yet, just waiting for confirmation, but always got great guests. And don't forget, if you've got any suggestions for me, please drop me a message, and I'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by the Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.